ExoSkin, we know it's good gear.
And so does Chad, right? And so do the Navy SEALs, because that's where Chad first experienced ExoSkin, and then it followed him to the trail. And it might as well be on you if it's good enough for the SEALs.
They make great gear. You need to go check them out at exoskin.com. And I just learned today, because I was talking to the guys at ExoSkin.
Is this the part where we whisper as a secret?
This is the part where we whisper. Hopefully they don't listen to this ad, because we're going to let the cat out of the bag.
All right, let's do it.
They are coming up with a new toe sock. It's a crew toe sock. It's not going to be available for maybe another couple weeks. So if you're listening to this on time, you may want to wait a week or go onto their website and just kind of keep checking in, because that new crew toe sock, which is going to be available, I think that's the one that I'm going to default to.
So what is it? No show, crew, ankle high, calf high?
I think crew is a little higher.
Okay.
That's good. That's what I like, because I think it keeps some of the dirt out of there.
It keeps the back of the shoe off the back of your Achilles. That's what I know.
All I know is the toe socks are easy to put on. They're easy to take off. Much, much easier than that other brand.
And let me give you a personal experience. So I ran with the other brand, and my runner on a dusty course ran with ExoSkin.
Yeah.
We pulled our shoes off after 50 miles, and you know what?
What?
Her feet were clean, and mine were dusty.
Really?
Yep.
That's interesting.
Yeah, it's great stuff.
How about blisters? Of course, you don't get blisters very often, do you?
Well, don't jinx me, my friend. But I don't get blisters because I'm in ExoSkin socks, and they have the great, great material, and it works spectacular.
Go to our partners page. We have a discount available there. Go to trailrunnernation.com, click on the partners link, and you too can give it a try with ExoSkin. Ultra Running Magazine. You know, it's the periodical for our tribe. Some tribes use smoke signals. We use Ultra Running Magazine.
We do. And to further this messaging, we've been given 12 annual subscriptions from Ultra Running Magazine.
That's correct. And we want to give them away.
Yes, we do. One a month is what we're going to do, Scott.
Yep.
And do you remember back in the day when you would see some contests of some kind where they're reading their actual journal on in some specific environment, right?
I think I remember that, you back know, in the day.
It might be like Motor Trend or something. It might be in an outhouse, and you know, somebody opens the door and snaps a picture.
Let's get to the game here. Here is the game. You are tasked with taking an Ultra Running Magazine issue,
yes,
and taking a photo in the most bizarre place that you submit that photo. So you'll go onto social media and tag it. Trail Runner Nation, and so that we can
and Ultra Running
see it,
Magazine.
And Ultra Running Magazine, and we will choose every month the most bizarre or creative place that you're reading your magazine, and we'll give you another 1 year subscription to Ultra Running Magazine.
So the outhouse is out, is what you're saying?
As long as it's kid friendly.
Okay, well let's give away some of these year-long subscriptions, and I look forward to seeing what these things look like.
We have some creative people in the tribe. I expect to see a lot of fun with this contest.
Go out and create.
Mass. You know, Don, sometimes it's hard to get that cross-training workout done with our busy schedules.
Every single coach we talk to expresses how important it is to have an overall fit body with cross-training.
Peloton has come up with a new solution called Tread.
It's fantastic. You have organized classes, any kind of classes, a boot camp class to give you overall fitness level. You can do a walking class. You can do a running class. You can do a strength class.
They have instructors that will walk you through a workout, or you can do a class online.
Literally, you could do a different workout every single day and never get bored.
I went and looked at one of these things, and it's really a piece of art first, but secondly, has a big screen that makes you feel like you're in the class when you're sitting at home at the convenience of your home.
It doesn't matter what time of the day it is, before work, at your lunchtime, or after work before you go to bed. You need to get that workout in. You want to feel good about what you've done? There you go. Get on the Tread.
And here's the deal that they have for us. If you go to onepeloton.com, that's onepeloton.com, and enter the code TRN, you get $100 off of accessories when you purchase one of their tread machines.
That's onepeloton.com, Scott?
Yes. Enter TRN as that code to get $100 off.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls of the wide worldwide ultra running community, you are listening to nothing less than the greatest Trail Running Nation podcast on earth. It is the Trail Runner Nation podcast.
All right, are we ready?
Yeah.
But I know it's on the upper edge, and you guys won a couple of awards.
All right, are we ready?
Yeah.
Thanks for joining. You're going to say welcome to.
I was going
to. I'm going to say thanks for joining another edition of Trail Runner Nation. I'm Scott Warr.
And I'm Don Freeman.
And we have Coach Ian Sharman on the
what are you going to call this?
Zoom.
Zoom.
We have him on the Zoom.
That's
We abandoned Skype. We're not endorsed by Skype. We're not endorsed by Zoom, but we hate Skype.
We hate the thing
can
Skype.
Can we be sued for that?
You can. I'm taking another position. We just hate the thing Skype does to us sometimes.
It is frustrating. We found that Zoom has smoothed all of those things out that we didn't like.
We only have a short time with Ian. Let's get him on. We'll talk about Zoom later.
This isn't a podcast.
Hi guys. Yeah, I managed to get my Zoom up and running. I never even heard of it, but seems to be working good.
Well, awesome. Hopefully it won't disappoint. You know, we follow Ian on social media, and he posted a post, I think it was last week sometime, about why suffering setbacks could make you more successful. It was an article published by the BBC by Ian Leslie back in mid-July. And the title is what caught me. And we reached out to Ian. Actually, Ian reached out to us and said, hey, it's been a while. And I said, hey, let's do it about this topic. And he said, sure, we can talk about this topic.
Yeah. And correct me if my math is wrong. It's really not my strong suit. But in any given race or in any given event in life, trying to get a job, what have you, there are more losers than winners.
That's good.
Yeah.
Your math is good.
Okay. And so this article really applies to any of us and all of us in any endeavor that we do.
Ian, what attracted you to this topic?
I think it was just a kind of universal theme there that, you know, you often hear stories of someone achieving great things. And then when you hear behind it, they've usually overcome something. You know, there's a million things that could be, but not many people nail really difficult things at the first attempt, which when you think about it is obvious. You know, someone gets the top of a field not by just being the best forever, but by learning along the way. And you learn a lot more from failures than you do from success. So, I mean, the first ultra example that immediately sprung to mind for me was Jim Walmsley has a slow Western States where he goes off course, then he has a DNF, and then he gets two course records in a row. And so, you know, he clearly had learned and refined things, and that failure also drives you on. It gives you the motivation. But the thing I found really fascinating about the article was saying that often it's a prerequisite for doing really well. That if you have that success immediately, you know, maybe you start running and you find your first race, you win it or something like that, having done hardly any training, then it doesn't necessarily spur you on to do more. You sometimes need that failure to give you a reason to push harder and to get deeper into it. And this also applied, you know, to work life, family life, everything else. And it seemed to just make so much sense and be so obvious that this would be the case, but yet be quite insightful and useful to all of us.
You know, and this flies in the face of what we're doing to our kids today, where we're giving everybody a participation trophy. There are no losers. You know, it doesn't matter what the score is.
You protect them from any harm. You know, we heard about helicopter parents, but these are snowplow parents moving everything out of the way so there is no problems for this child to overcome.
And those parents need to read this article because this shows data that successful people do have those failures and they have to learn to deal with those failures. And that's the thing that I thought was interesting. There's a statistic, and if I can find it, you probably know this right off the top of your head, Ian, about the gold medal athletes versus the silver medal athletes.
I don't have the stats in front of me. It made sense that the ones who do the best and particularly the ones that continue doing well are the ones that maybe didn't get the gold medal the first attempt, or, you know, they weren't necessarily the best athlete at high school, but then they are the best athlete in the world later on. And again, looking at ultras, a good portion of the people you see there, they weren't necessarily the top high school track athlete or the top Division 1 heading towards the Olympics type of person. In fact, you know, pretty much no one has had that career path. The only Olympian I can really think of with a lot of success in ultras is Magda Boulay. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that was later in her career that she's having that success at ultras. But, yeah, it makes perfect sense. And I like your point there about how we think that maybe if we protect kids or friends or whatever from having that failure, then that's making their life easier. It's probably making their life harder because then failures are inevitable, you know, that you have setbacks in life. I always use this in the context of businesses in particular, that no one ever sets up a good business or has a good career where every step was just dead easy and they had no challenges to overcome. It's not avoiding challenges that makes you good at something. It's how you deal with them. And that is the essence of ultra running, really. So that's why I thought this had such an overlap to the kind of thing we're all particularly interested in.
You know, I'm glad you brought up the business point. I was listening to a podcast on my run this morning, one that I just discovered called Masters of Scale. And he was talking about the guy who founded LinkedIn. LinkedIn was a pivot. They wanted to create this game, and the game they had sunk tons of time, tons of money into, and they finally had to pull the plug on that and say, you know what, this isn't working, it's failing. And they pulled the plug and then looked at what they had accomplished or what they had learned, and they said, you know what, there may be an opportunity with this LinkedIn thing. And it took off like crazy. So failure could be the mother of invention. I wanted to mention this study. It was done by Adam Leave. I hope that's his name. He's an economist at University of Virginia, and they studied a database of medal winners,
Medal winners.
Yeah, from track and field between 1846 and 1948. And this is what they found: that athletes who just missed out on the top podium spot went on to live longer, more successful lives than those who won. The silver medal athletes were more ambitious in their post-sports careers, finding better paid jobs, and they ended up living longer.
Hmm.
That can't be a coincidence.
Well, what happens if we don't even get on the podium?
We should live forever.
Yeah, there you go. And you and I are in good spots, Scott.
It's not a curve there, Freeman. Okay. Like there's a direct correlation. Well, anyway.
Hey, so here's another name that, as you were speaking there, yeah, Ian, that I thought of: Michael Jordan. We all know that story, right? I say we all know it, and here I'm trying to figure the facts out. It was like his sophomore year, he didn't make the team or something like that. And then he goes on to become, well, Michael Jordan. And so sometimes missing makes you motivated, makes you train harder, get up without an alarm clock, choose the right thing on your diet plan because you're hungry to win. And I don't know if you can be hungry if you're on top of the podium, if you never lose, if everything comes to you so easy, where does the drive come from? You deal with a lot of elite athletes, Ian, and being one yourself. When you're winning all the time, where do you summons the drive to continue winning?
Well, I think the difficulty can be not to just... you know, when things are going well, they can keep going well for a while. But what happens when they start going badly? If you're used to winning every race, and then you get second, or you get a much worse race than that, how do you reconcile that and deal with it? Because for some people, it's like, that's a failure. You know, to have not won it is such a disappointment that their drive can completely disappear. So I can totally understand, you know, someone who's got an Olympic gold medal, that's the pinnacle of what they've aimed for pretty much their whole life. And they can't outdo it. They can get another gold medal, but they can't improve on it. So they've basically peaked. And that's going to take some of the drive away. It's like, I think a good analogy here would be a lottery winner. It's someone who gets that huge amount of money. They haven't had to work for it. And they're not really going to, you know, suddenly get more money or get something that improves on that aspect of their life in another way. So they can just often become, you know, kind of layabouts and get in debt and lose all of it and actually be a lot less happy than maybe if they'd have not had that lottery win, which again seems counterintuitive, but it seems completely backed up by the data that I don't know if it's most lottery winners go bankrupt, but I know it's a large proportion of them.
I think it's all.
Hey, layabouts, is that from your neck of the woods, or am I just missing out on that term? Layabouts.
A layabout, yeah, that's an English phrase, definitely for someone who's like the kid who doesn't bother, you know, going to university, and they just stay at home and play video games all day and don't bother getting a job. there are layabouts. They're just laying about all day rather than doing anything.
20-year-olds. Hey, so we've got a bell curve picture in your mind.
And Don had to draw one. I see his paper right here. And he had to draw a bell curve because...
It helps me remember, Scott. Okay. You have so many questions that I get disrupted completely because they're so engaging that I forget mine. So I've got to make pictures.
He doesn't have any labels on it. It's just a bell curve.
So I've got this bell curve. And I know the answer is going to be, well, it depends on the athlete. You know, where their happy spot is really depends on their personality. So hold that for a second. But just entertain this. Where do you think the happy place is in the bell curve where most of the people are content as runners? Where do you think that exists?
That's tough. I mean, I think the defining feature of runners and you know that competitive element to what we're doing is you're always trying to improve. So whether you just beat the cutoffs, whether you're trying a new distance, whether you've won stuff, you're never satisfied with where you've got to. I think actually being able to enjoy the successes you have is a very difficult thing for everyone. I'm not sure anywhere in that bell curve people are necessarily content with where they are. That's more just if they have the right mentality, then they can get the enjoyment out of the sport. And maybe in some cases that would be after their competitive element has gone on. And so they can say, okay, well now I can just enjoy it rather than caring about getting quicker than the last one.
Yeah, it sounds like there's room anywhere in that bell curve for happiness as long as you're mentally approaching it properly. And I didn't think of this until you started speaking on the topic. It sounds like if you're improving on something, if you've picked something out and you've made advancement with it and you're satisfied with execution, the race gets a smile. And, you know, really doesn't matter about time. It doesn't matter about many other things. But if you've improved on a target, then that race gets a happy face.
And again, it applies to everything. That as long as you've got a constant learning process, then it's satisfying. As long as you feel like you're progressing. Anything in life that you do where you're not getting any better, you're not somehow moving on, it gets boring. You know, who cares? If you keep knocking out the same marathon time, you stop really caring about that. It's not really, and so maybe you switch to a different type of running or a longer distance, like a lot of people will do. But one of the other things I want to bring up from that study was that, again, it's in the same ballpark of discussion, but it wasn't obvious to me at all. But they had a study where they looked at a random sample of 573 eminent people who merited more than one column in encyclopedias. So basically people who'd achieved stuff. Mm-hmm. And they found that nearly half had had a parent die before they were 20. So also having had loss as a child fitted in with this same concept that, again, it's the overcoming adversity early on was tended to put, you know, not to say that it is a good thing to lose a parent, but that it actually was one factor related to all of this that spurred people on to achieve more and to be more driven rather than having the, I suppose you could say, easier life of both parents still being alive and no issues.
Yeah, it makes complete sense. I always love trying to pick a thing's part anthropologically. Why would that be? But if you lose one of your main support group, your foundation, you will have to perform at a higher level. It's just probably wired into our DNA to summons more effort, more courage, more determination, more perseverance when we don't have as much to fall back on.
And Don and I were just joking because in the article, of course, they bring up the Beatles and that three of the four Beatles lost parents early in their lives. And maybe that's a reason why they worked hard.
Maybe that's why they were at I Want to Hold Your Hand.
Oh!
Sorry, Scott.
Hey, Ian, here's my question.
Also, just related to that on a more comedy note.
Oh, that wasn't comedy, Ian. That was my best.
You have that? It's Ringo, obviously.
Ian is correcting your comedy.
Oh, I stepped all over his comedy.
Comedy.
We'll have to edit that out.
Go ahead, Ian.
I was just saying, yeah, so unsurprisingly, of the four Beatles, the one who didn't have the early loss is Ringo. So imagine how good that band could have been. Imagine how good the drumming would have been with that extra factor.
Had his mother taken a wrong turn that day off a corner.
Hey, yeah. No, so, it's my turn.
Okay.
It's my turn. I said I did this.
Oh, I didn't.
Hey, Ian, as a coach, you're coaching not only elite athletes, but non-elites. And inevitably, they're going to fail at whatever level. Let's say it's a non-elite that is...
Even elites fail, Scott.
Well, I know, but all I'm right. saying let's say it's a non-elite and they're trying to go after a new distance, let's say, and they fail. how as a coach do you help them put that in perspective and learn from it and put it into a motivational context so that they do better the next time and become better?
I think it's one of the fundamental things that a coach can do, which because everyone is inevitably going to have things that don't go quite to plan. In ultra running, if you manage to nail every race, then you're setting the bar low for yourself. You're clearly within your comfort zone to quite a big degree. So this is something that is inevitable with anyone pushing the boundaries, whatever level they're at. And I always say that it's good to have an approach that it is both for running and training, as it is for everything in life, which is being able to look at the positive in everything. So when you do have a failure, as long as you can work out what you can improve, what you can do better, and make yourself a better runner as a result of it, then that's a massive positive. And you typically learn more from a bad race than a good race. So that's the same with anything in life, and especially actually with things going wrong in mid-race to fix it and get it back on track. That mentality to turn a negative into a positive and to be able to kind of spin things in a more productive way is what will keep you able to push yourself and keep you much more motivated. So here's a good example. You know, something that might seem obviously bad is you've taken a wrong turn, you've added on a mile. And so now you're going to do 101 miles instead of 100. You lost some time, you lost some places. You feel really negative about that, understandably. But you could also say, okay, well, now how well can I get back on this? How well can I avoid making a mistake in the next few miles by trying to catch all of that time back up immediately, which in hindsight would be obviously stupid, but in the moment it can seem very tempting. And also you can say things like, okay, well, I've done 100 miles before. Now I'm going to do 101. This is my longest run ever. That's kind of cool. There's always positives you can get out of it. I actually had this happen at Leadville the last time I was there, where I'd added on somewhere around a mile by missing the turn right after halfway. And I was in second, and I thought, oh, great. Now I thought I was about 5 minutes behind. Now I'm probably 15 minutes behind. But I also thought to myself, okay, well, that makes it more interesting. Now I've got to chase down 15 minutes in 50 miles rather than five. So that is a bigger challenge for me, which means that it will matter more at the end. And so that really got me through the next 10 miles. And at that point, I found out the guy ahead of me had done exactly the same thing. So I'd actually passed him, and I was a bit confused. I was going over Pope Pass, which is the big climb you get right after 50 miles. And everyone's going, oh, yeah, you're in the lead. Good stuff. And I'm like, no, I'm not. There's a guy ahead of me. What are you talking about? You must have just missed him. Or maybe he was in the bushes when you came by. But I didn't allow myself to realize that until I formally asked someone at an aid station and said, yeah, you're in the lead. But up until that point, I could easily have got very frustrated, then just had my head down, gone slowly up that climb. And instead, by turning that into a more positive thought, it made me hyper-motivated and actually improve my performance rather than reducing it. So I always tell people that's the key to success in ultras is you're inevitably going to have setbacks. You're inevitably going to have challenges and difficult parts to it. So how you approach that is what an ultra is about. So in effect, when something goes wrong in an ultra, I always tell people to kind of say game on. Okay, it's easy to run well when everything's going well. How well can you run when it's not going well? And that is a way more positive outlook than as soon as something goes a little bit wrong, you start feeling negative and get down on yourself and slow down and make more mistakes.
Yeah, inevitably in a long run, 50 miles, 25, 100 miles, something is going to go wrong for you, and it did. And something you can bet is going to go wrong for your competitor. You know, has it happened yet? It may happen twice. And if you take yourself out of the race early, then you have sabotaged yourself because you're about to get a gift later on down the line where they're going to make their mistake. Because we all make them. They're out there for each one of us on a long run waiting.
But not to necessarily count on that.
Oh, sure.
It's not that you need something else to go wrong for other people for you to then be kind of evening things out. But just to say, okay, well, anything that makes it harder makes it more worthwhile. That is really what ultra running is. That's why 100 miler is a lot more satisfying to people than 50 miles because it's tougher. So the fact that there's an additional challenge in there is really the thing that adds to the value of the race. And the more people can see this, same in training, you get a setback, you get an injury or you get something that goes wrong and then you overcome that and you still get to the race start line and then you go for it. That it just makes it that much more special to then have a good finish and to know that you've overcome it as well as you possibly could. So that's definitely the main way I try and reinforce that to people. So it's funny, sometimes I'll have a call where someone's just had a bad race, or they picked up an injury or something has gone wrong and they're feeling down in the dumps. And I put it this way, and they say, you know what? I actually feel kind of good about this thing going wrong now because I know that it's going to make me a better runner and help give more value to the next possible year or two of races.
Do you think you're more of a physical coach or a mental coach sometimes, Ian?
I would say it's probably more the mental side of things. Yeah. It's much more about how you cope with stuff in races. So a lot of that comes down to the experience. You've got to have a bare minimum of fitness to get through certain races. But I'd always say to people, it's better to have a lower level of fitness and be smart enough and mentally tough enough to get 95% of what you're capable of doing on the day than that you're super fit, but you only get 50% of what you're capable of doing because you make all these mistakes or you just give in because you're not going to get your A goal. And so you just walk it in or whatever it may be. So I will always take someone who can be mentally tough over someone who can be just physically fit because that will count for a lot more. And so I spend most of my time talking about this kind of thing with pretty much everyone I'm coaching. At some point, this exact topic comes up.
As you're talking through a race and what can go wrong in a race and how to overcome mistakes or problems that you face during a race, I'm thinking once again how a race is a microcosm of life. That in a race, let's say it's a 24-hour or 30-hour or 48-hour race, you're able to experience failure or mistakes or issues and learn how to overcome those. And those experiences can translate to, you know, better fitness or better racing, but also into your personal and professional lives. That's always fun to make that analogy.
Oh, definitely. I think that ultra runners become hopefully better humans, but certainly better at dealing with life's difficulties by becoming a better runner. Because you just learn to just that process of going through overcoming difficulties and what it takes to do that, about not just giving in at the first sign of difficulty and problem solving and staying positive, those things that you reinforce with each good race and often with a bad race as well, because then you can improve on those specifics for the next one.
Hey, Ian, I'm just curious. You've coached a lot of athletes. Can you think of an athlete that really failed over and over and over again, but turned that failure into an ultimate success?
Yeah, I mean, often most runners might have two or three bad races. And I get a lot of people who come to me who they've just had a load of DNFs in a row. Maybe they've started doing 100-milers and they just can't finish them, even though they're very fit runners. So I've had plenty of people who, often it's the distance that, you know, they have the fitness, but they're not able to problem solve well enough. They don't have the experience of the difference between running a marathon fast and running a long trail race well. So I'd say I've actually got a good number of people. And one of the main reasons people come to me is because they're experiencing failure. They're not doing as well as they hoped, or they keep DNFing. And so a lot of that is obviously specific problem solving of what was the issue. Was it that you didn't do enough training? You know, is it that it was a hot race and you didn't do heat training? You didn't realize that would be something you'd need to do. So there's some of it that is 100% physical, but so many of them, it is, you know, mental aspects of just saying it's okay to have bad patches in a race. And again, particularly people coming from a road background, the idea of, you know, having to slow down and walk or sit in an aid station or be vomiting and it still be a good race can feel quite foreign to them, because they're used to the idea that in, you know, running a road race, you run hard, and a bad race is that you slow down a few seconds a mile at the end, not that it goes horrifically wrong and then you rescue it or rescue it multiple times. So a lot of it is talking through, you know, the differences between some of the shorter distances and the long distances. And a lot of it is just the mentality of saying, when you get these setbacks, that's what this kind of ultra running is about, rather than having to avoid them completely. So I would say it's actually a good portion of the people I coach that have had that, at least at some point in their career, where they have a number of bad races or DNFs and have to cope with it.
Yeah, Ian, you know, that's why I love the sport. You can put a bib on and you can bend over with your hands on your knees, vomit. You can lay on a cot with somebody dressing up your feet with bandages, and you can have the race of your life. Mm-hmm. That's my kind of sport.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at some of the best performances ever, some amazing course records, it wasn't that those runners had a perfect day. Ellie Greenwood, when she set the course record at Western States, she didn't actually have an awesome race. She had some bad patches. And then near the end, someone mentioned that she was actually on course record pace. And she was well under course record pace, like an hour under, and didn't even realize it. Wow. Because she thought she was having a crappy day. She was in the lead, admittedly, but she didn't think it was a great race. And then suddenly you look at it at the end, and because she's dealt with things and kept moving well, it's an out-of-the-park, amazing performance. So it's not like this is just the people who are rescuing a bad day. Often it's people having that amazing day, even at the very top end of the sport.
Hey, Ian, candidly, because no one will listen to this section of the podcast, but candidly...
What? Why is that, Scott? Ian's on it.
Candidly, have you ever wished one of your athletes had a big failure so they could learn something and become a better athlete?
Ooh, you don't have to answer that.
There is a question. It's difficult because you never want anyone to have failure. But I have to admit, sometimes I feel like it can be useful to do that. Especially if it's someone maybe who has just had a lot of good races, but I can tell they're not pushing the boundaries of what they're going for. They're staying within the type of race they know they can already do. And so I'd rather maybe they do a longer or a more mountainous or a hotter or something that they're not used to and have a race that doesn't go perfectly, because then that also gets them okay with the concept of it not being perfect the whole time. So it can help them get to that next level. So it's not like we pick a race on purpose for them to fail, but it is good to pick a race that is going to really get them out of their comfort zone and see how they can cope with that and maybe deal with not being the best guy there and how that affects their ego and their ability to still keep pushing.
I spent about 20 years working with the Roseville football, high school football team, and I would never, ever openly admit this in front of anybody, but I will in front of us.
This is still the candid part of the podcast.
This is still the candid part. And you know, you always want an undefeated team, but uh-huh. I always root for a 5-5 team. I don't want a 1-9 team or a nine and one because there's not enough lessons there. But a perfect blend is to win and to lose, to learn the lessons from victory and the lessons and the growth from defeat. And so I silently wished for everybody to get up off the field after the play was over, because that's when my play came in, if I had to run out there. And so I wanted everybody to stand up. And I wanted a 5-5 team because those were the best, and they had the most character, and they had the most hope to go out there and win. And they weren't so defeated by the sixth loss in a row that they still wanted to practice hard. So it was a good blend and made for a great culture.
And related to that, I think we're kind of assuming that success is down to a fast time or a good position. That's not the only part of success in ultra running. A big part of success can be having that failure and then overcoming it the next time, or just being able to do something you couldn't do before. It doesn't necessarily mean that you have to do it faster or better. Maybe it could be that as you age, that you manage to, even if your top speed isn't as high, that you manage to do things better. And that can mean a lot of different things. It's not just about time and place. So that's another thing I try and reinforce to people, because it's so easy to measure success, especially in running, with those really objective outcome goals. And I try to tell people to focus more on the process of it all. You know, are you enjoying your training more? Maybe someone was having, you know, some good races, but they just were miserable training and it was not very sustainable. And that then if they didn't get a PR the next time, the whole thing would seem like a waste of time. Well, if you can change that, the process is actually something that means something to them. And it's not just about whatever the clock says at the end of the race. Then that's a big win. These are the kind of things that are really much more meaningful success, especially when you look back at it years later, rather than just, did you knock 10 seconds off your PR? You know, that's not always something that's really going to mean much, but it can seem like the only important thing in advance.
If you could rate happiness, here I am, not with the smiley faces, but actually with numbers. And we took that happiness factor from the top three, the people standing on the podium, the top three, and we added those numbers up. And then we went to the back of the race, the golden hour people, the people just coming in at the last moments, and you added their happiness factor up. Who do you think would be ahead in that equation?
That's really difficult to say.
Yeah.
I think a lot of it depends on where their expectations were. Mm-hmm. So the guy who comes second, who expected to be first, is not happy. Mm. But the person who finishes a 30-hour cutoff in 29:59, who didn't know they could finish, is pretty damn ecstatic.
Very
it's
happy.
Difficult to beat that. So just from a pure happiness and enjoyment of the sport, I'm not sure that's particularly correlated with just an objective success that isn't factoring at least age and experience and expectations.
In the article, it talks about power lifters and weight guys who train with weights, and how it is the actual breaking down of the muscle that allows that muscle to repair itself and become stronger. And Don is nodding because he used to be a power lifter, and so I'm just verifying because he's nodding. Here's my question for you as a coach again, Ian. A lot of times we structure training, whether it's with a coach like yourself or whether it's our own, where we put ourselves in a situation where we can fail or will likely fail in a training run, so that we can experience that problem solving mentality of overcoming a failure. How often do you include that in a training plan, and how important is that?
Not too often, because you want to have, you know, momentum and success going into a race to feel confident. But it's good to have some stuff that maybe beats you up a little bit. Maybe it's the first hilly run of the season. Maybe it's the first speed session. You say, okay, well, there's room to improve there. And so also because you can see that there's that improvement ahead, it's more motivating than if it's just something that you completely fail at and feel bad about. But also, you know, you don't want to wear someone down mentally before the race, so they're just exhausted from having all these really hard sessions that wipe them out, and they can never quite achieve what they're aiming for. So I wouldn't say I'm aiming to overcome people and try and push them too hard, but you definitely want to be getting people to the limit of what they can do, both physically and mentally. And again, it depends on where the person comes from. Some people I know are just mentally tough as nails. We don't need to work on that in the build-up to the race. They're just going to get it right. And so we just want to get their fitness where it needs to be. Other people, they might have loads of fitness, but we've got to be working on the mental side, in which case we want to do things that they don't like doing as much sometimes. Maybe it's night running. Maybe it is doing something in a way that's going to slow them down and make them have to at least be more challenged than just doing the same workout they know they can do well and succeeding with it.
Have you ever had a runner too tough where you had to turn them down a little bit?
I think it's more runners that I make them do less than they want to do than runners that I force them to do more than they want to do. There's definitely some with lack of motivation, and it's just that constant prodding. You know, you've got to fit in the runs, otherwise you're not going to see the benefits. But ultra runners do tend to be quite type A, as do all runners. And so there's that tendency to try and do too much. So yeah, it's very common that I'm saying, let's just tone down the amount of training there. We don't need that amount of volume. Or they keep adding on, you know, 20% extra to every run. And I'm saying, look, we're getting the stimulus from what I'm putting in the plan. If we overdo it, you might actually be less fit, not more fit. So it's, again, depends on the mentality a lot there.
I was just thinking as you were talking about how you coach, I think, okay, if I was a coach and I want to make a lot of money coaching, I would make the workouts as easy as possible so that they, after every workout, they're going, I feel awesome. You're the best coach in the whole world. But maybe
then the race comes.
The race comes and they don't.
That's the problem. You see, that person likes you for a month, and then when they don't have success, they don't hire you anymore because they don't get any improvement.
You have a long-term perspective. I like that, Ian. Yeah. Long-term perspective.
So we won't see your name at CharmanAlter.com as one of your many coaches.
Ian will not accept my resume as a coach.
You're going to give him like 1 mile easy jogs and say, if you can do a 15-minute mile pace, you're going to nail that
200-mile race.
Speaking of nailing races, I'd like to bring this up as to discuss. I've always been under the at least the position that everybody at the start line, if they execute the race well, can finish. They're you know, unless they have a serious injury or there is an underlying flu or something that they have, or they twist an ankle, people are put together enough, they've shown up in enough fitness shape. Most of the problems become execution of the 50% finishers or 30% non-finishers. There's a lot of people that don't get all the way through it not because of fitness level, just execution.
Definitely. I mean, there's always going to be some people who maybe they had an injury in the build-up, and so they're either injured at the race or they didn't get enough training, and they're really going to be pushing the absolute limit of what they can physically do to finish under the time. Or, you know, maybe it's at Western States or something, and it's a 75-year-old, and so they're inevitably a bit slower. And so, again, they're going to be really pushing it to get under those times. But for most people, certainly being able to finish it and finish it well, I'd say it's very feasible if they can execute well. And one thing I'm always reinforcing with people is, particularly in the longer races, it's much more about how well you can be moving at the end of it. So if you just think of the pure numbers, like a, let's say 30 hour cutoff for 100 miler, that is not a fast pace. That's like an 18 minute mile you've got to do on average. All the people at that starting line can do an 18 minute mile walking on the flat. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they'll be a bit slower going uphill, but if you assume that they're going to run a good portion of it, especially the flatter, easier bits, and that they'll slow down a bit, if they can just avoid catastrophic slowing down where they're death marching or where they spend 3 hours in an aid station passed out or something, then just the pure mathematical side of it is that you've just got to avoid something going really wrong and keep moving. But that's the difficulty, that when things go really wrong, you can slow down that much. So much of a longer, tougher ultra is about just trying to avoid catastrophe or minimize it. If you see it coming, try and head it off before it really costs you a lot of hours and forces you to just be kind of limping it in at 30-minute mile pace on the flat. And I know a friend who, for example, at the Spartathlon, which is a super hardcore race, 153 miles, 36-hour cutoff in heat, and he had 1 hour to complete the last mile, and he only just did it. That's how much he was slowing down. So obviously, if you tell him that he's on pace, that he's got 1 mile left in an hour in advance, it sounds dead easy. But it's really just trying to avoid getting to that point where, or at least pushing it off to as close enough to the end that it's not going to force you to fail.
Yeah, if you would have had him perform that mile in the very beginning, he would have laughed at you. But at the end,
he could have crawled it at that pace.
Yeah,
literally crawled.
Yeah, one of the best lessons I learned out there was just as I kind of assessed my slower pace starting, and I'm a little bit frustrated and thinking, you know what, this I'm moving a little slow here. And you look around at the runners, and since they're all running a bit faster than they should, by just that's because that's how we do it. You look around and you go, I'm usually ahead of these people. Maybe I'm moving too slow. But then I ask that question: if I could run like this in the last 20% of the race, would I be happy? That's absolutely. I'm moving great for the last 20. We'll be happy with the first 20 at this pace too. So I try to control my frustration with thinking, man, if I was moving this fast, this well, this smooth at mile 80, this is a great race.
You should turn a resume into Charmin running. This
is the kind of thing though, it's difficult, or it's easy to say it in advance and know what you're meant to do, but in the heat of the moment, it's easy to make those mistakes. And a good example I always use is how hard should you push on the first climb of an ultra? And the rule of thumb I always use is, would you be running this if it was a climb right at the end of the race? Or how fast would you be doing it at that point, realistically? And if the answer is that there's no hope in hell that you would be running any of it, then you probably shouldn't be running much, if any, of it at the beginning. You're just doing it because you're fresh, because you haven't got however many miles in your legs. So that is always a good question to ask yourself if you need, in the moment, to know a decision factor about should you be running or hiking.
Gosh, I wonder if tapering has sabotaged us a bit, because we miss running. We need to get out there. Our legs are fresh. They feel like springs. And so we get out there and go, go, go. Maybe we sabotage ourselves with all this great taper.
I'm feeling too good.
Feeling too
good.
But then
that's why, again, it's the mental side. It's not the physical side.
Sure.
You've got to improve there.
Yeah.
It's purely the discipline and the tactics and these kind of things that improve with age and more races that you do. So again, where you have a bad race and you make a mistake, as long as you learn from it from next time of how did that feel, what did you do, and how was the context of that versus other races, then you keep becoming better. And it's really satisfying to do that. And even if you're getting to the point where you can't get any faster, you're getting beyond the age where you're physically capable of getting better at the short stuff, there's all these big gains to be made in other things that are very, very meaningful. Even if you can't hit another 5K PR, you can still be hitting these much longer distance PRs through stuff that is unrelated to how physically fit you are.
Yeah, you just described the veteran ultra runner, somebody that has...
I'm also thinking ahead to myself quite soon.
No, we've seen your times. You've got a ways to wait. But the decision-making, seeing things before they become a problem, that just takes experience. And you need to have, part of the topic we're talking about is it's good when trauma happens. You have catastrophes occur so you can grow. Well, you can't recognize things coming at you until they've hit you at least once in the past. Like, it sounds like a truck coming, probably going to get hit. The sooner that you can hear that truck, the better off you are, whether it comes to nutrition or pace or heat or climbing the hills, or, you know, you name all the variables that are happening out there, you've got to have been struck by them a few times along the way to become that veteran ultra runner.
Yeah, that's where they.
But you don't necessarily have to have the same thing go wrong again for you to learn from it. Mm-hmm. I think that was the point about this article, that trauma, whether it's losing a parent or something else, or not being the best initially, it just teaches you then to be able to do that problem solving, to have that discipline, to work harder, to have that drive. And that is the bit that can apply. So maybe in one race, your nutrition's wrong. And so you kind of fix that, and that's the common sense thing. But maybe something else is starting to go wrong. You say, okay, I recognize these kind of feelings of this is not how it should be. What is causing this? And you cope with it. But not just that you fix the physical thing. You also say mentally, I'm going to deal with this. I've overcome adversity before. So whatever the new adversity is, I will be able to cope with it. That's where I think the trauma has the effect next time of making you better.
You know, one of the things that I love about this sport is the mentorship that we enjoy. And sometimes I think, in fact, I know that I haven't had some of the failures because I've had good mentors. Where
you've had snow plowing parents getting things out of your way.
Not necessarily. I think that the mentors that I have, you're one of them, that recounted their failure and how you grew from that failure, or they grew from that failure, and I learned from that vicariously. And there's some things that you absolutely need to experience on your own. I mean, you don't know what that pain cave or that dark place is just because somebody talked about it. You can learn how they overcame it. And maybe that's the way that you overcome, but I think people are individuals, and maybe the way I get out of that dark place is different than you. But knowing that there's a dark place versus not knowing.
Learning the early sensations of thirst. You know, it's not dry mouth. There's other clues that are coming before that. You know, an early cramp, something just subtle. You don't wait until you're on the ground trying to stretch your leg out. You feel something coming early, so you make changes. So it's important to experience those. But I, too, had people in front of me as mentors handing mm-hmm. things down. It's just the tribal way. And coaches are a great resource because, you know, they've heard 100 different scenarios. And so it's easy for them to pull from those experiences and share them with you. So you don't have to be on the trail in a heavily populated area getting these mentors. They're available at Charmin Ultra.
and you don't have to go through the whole learning curve yourself. So whether it's a coach or just being well-read about training philosophies and coaching manuals from various things, and also podcasts. I mean, so many people I know learn so much from podcasts because there's a lot of good information out there. And you don't have to have gone through every single thing yourself, but you have to go through some adversity yourself, mm-hmm. definitely. It just doesn't have to be necessarily exactly the same thing. I mean, it took me 20-odd 100-milers before I vomited in any race. So I'd learned a little bit about how to avoid that, but then I had to go through that experience myself. I'd had other things that had gone wrong in the past that allowed me to cope with it better and to try and right the ship at that point.
That's 2,000 miles, if I'm doing my math right. I started the podcast with a math exercise, and I'm getting towards the end and doing some math too.
Hey, Ian, this is a two-part question. As an athlete yourself and then as a coach, how important is that evaluation phase after a race? Whether there's a failure or not, let's assume that there is. For yourself, when are you looking and looking back at how you executed and overcame these challenges? And then the second part of that question is how quickly do you get with your athletes after a race event to evaluate?
Well, I say in both cases, it's really important to, first of all, acknowledge all the successes. Even if things weren't perfect, it's really important that you can say, okay, well, you finished the race, or you got further than you've ever gone before, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. You know, bank the good stuff first, because that's really important. Otherwise, if you immediately just start focusing on the negatives, you know, again, it goes the opposite of what I was saying before, that you've got to turn negatives into positives. So mm-hmm. yes, you want to learn from things, but you also want to say, okay, well, lots of things went really well first. You know, the majority, the big stuff, that went well, even if it wasn't all perfect. And so you want to keep striving for perfection, there's more to it than that. So I will typically know what I did well and what I didn't do as well within about a day, you know, that you need a little bit of self-reflection to really take it all in. And then I try to make sure that I don't make those mistakes again next time. Sometimes, though, it's just, you know, the tiniest little things that you're taking risks in races, especially if you're racing hard. And you say, okay, well, I rolled the dice that time, didn't pay off. If I were to do it a few other times, maybe it would have paid off with exactly the same scenario. And it's trying to work out what things you would genuinely change and what things you say, I had to try that. Otherwise, I had no chance of getting where I wanted to be. But generally speaking, a lot of it is more with at least some kind of safety margin of knowing if you did something stupid that you shouldn't have done. And so I do make sure that we go through that. And typically, both with an email after the race and then the next time we talk after a race with the people I'm coaching, we will go through that. But I'm very insistent both at the beginning of when we talk about that stuff and at the end to remind them of all the things that went well so that there's not a negative taste in their mouth afterwards, because typically that's not the appropriate thing. It's not going to be as helpful and also not as fun. I mean, if you've completed a race, particularly a 100-miler, that is a success in any scenario. It's very tough to do. And so even if it's not exactly the race you wanted, you still got to say, look, you know, it could have been a hell of a lot worse. And that's a big deal. Hardly anyone in the world completes 100-milers or 50-miles or any ultras, really. So acknowledge that first before critiquing the smaller stuff.
If a person wanted a coach, Ian, how long should they expect to need that coach? Maybe indefinitely, right? I mean, Tiger still has a coach. He's golfing. But what's the minimum prescription? You know, you've got to take your antibiotics for a while.
Like 3 months at a bare minimum to really see any kind of physical differences. And you want to have a chance to have some races in the build up to the target stuff you're focusing on, so you can learn from those and practice things. So I generally wouldn't advise less than 6 months. Mm-hmm. But I would say you can gain a huge amount of experience from one season with a coach. So whether it's the build up to one major race or one year of being with them, then you should be able to get a lot of information from them, a lot of habits, and just a different way of analyzing and looking at things. And some of that may even just be related to being able to get more enjoyment out of it, because they can change your perspective about how you're approaching it. And that alone may be enough to make a world of difference to your actual success in it too.
And I think taking the stress out of the whole plan, right? If you can mm-hmm. rely on somebody, that's one thing you don't have to worry about. All you need to do is do what your coach says.
Well, but you need to be honest in reporting, because
yeah.
you know,
yeah, and give feedback so it can be adjusted rather than just here's the next few weeks, do them regardless of how you feel. That's always a recipe for failure.
So how about rotating coaches? Do you so you spend a season? Would you ever recommend trying a different coach?
Yeah, I mean, we do have some people who, because I've got six other coaches working for me at Charmin Ultra. And so sometimes we have them work with one person for a while, and then they just want a change of perspective. And that can be good with fresh ideas and just a slightly new way of looking at things. Maybe if they're hitting a dead end in particular, or just they've had some success, but they just want to learn something a little bit different. So it's not that I necessarily recommend that you should switch coaches, but there's definitely some benefits to that. And I've had, we've had a good number of people who've done that over the years, or they work with one coach for one target and then come back a couple of years later and work with a different coach, just so they can kind of test themselves and see how they can do things differently and see what they gain from that.
Do your six coaches, and they're all the biggest names in the sport, because we've heard them before, and I could fail to mention all of them, so I'm not going to, but I know they're the big names. Do they have specialties like this? This is, you know, the type of, for this particular athlete, your best fit is this coach.
Definitely. I mean, that's the whole point, is each of the coaches has an overlap. Obviously, we're all focused on ultras and to a large degree, 100 milers, but some have different specialties. So me in particular, I'm very familiar with certain races like Western States, Leadville, Comrades, and also road running. So I try to be a little bit more broad-based. I've probably got a slightly wider experience than the rest. But there's someone like Zach Bitter. If you want to do a fast, flat 100-miler or a road marathon, he's kind of a specialist from our team, because that's what he has spent a lot of his career working on, and a lot of the people he's coaching do that kind of thing. And then someone like Ellie Greenwood, she's got the road and the trail background, but typically more runnable stuff, so things like Comrades, Western States. And then for the more rugged end of the scale, someone like Sean Meissner, who has train people for stuff like Tour de Jante, the multi-stage 200 milers and things like that. So each of them has just a little bit of a different perspective, which is really great for when we have our monthly chats, as well as any additional questions we ask each other through the month, because we can then use that combined experience. And maybe I'm coaching someone for a race that I'm not as familiar with, but one of the other coaches can give some extra insight there. So they all have just slightly different specialties in there, but all of them being fairly broad-based with ultras.
Well, that's good. I'll just put in my request. I'd like to win a golden ticket race coming up. So I'll submit on your Charmin Ultra, see if I can get a coach.
You don't know how many people want that. I've got so many people going, okay, we'll go to this, but you do realize how fast you're going to have to run to get that golden ticket. So, you know, let's not bank on that being 100% getting you in Western States. And, you know, we want to build people up, but also not just go all in on that kind of idea.
Check out CharminUltras.com. If you want to follow Ian on Twitter, go to Charminian. Charmin, go with to an IAN.
Go to Google, put in Ian Charmin Twitter, and you'll get there.
Yeah, hey, well, Ian, that works with any of the social media. Yeah.
Thank you very much. This was a great topic and a great discussion. We appreciate your wisdom and what you've shared on it.
Thanks, guys. Great chat.
Yep. Hey, we'll talk to you again soon. Hey, we need to do another thumbs up, thumbs down with the coaches, right? Yep.
Yes.
Let's get our other coaches on, and we'll pick some topics and we'll have fun.
Yeah, send an email to the three of us and we can put a date in sometime soon. I'm going to be away at UTMB in Europe for a few weeks, but sometime after mid-September would be good.
Let's do it. Okay. Have safe travels over to Europe. Enjoy UTMB.
Thanks, guys. Speak to you later.
Go out and run.
Mas.